This is For the Record program number 1114. The Chinese winter, weaponized media, social media, and the coronavirus biowarfare psyop part 2. This is being recorded on February 13th of the year 2020. I'm doing this program live, and as is my want, I'm being a little unconventional. For the record, 1113 has been recorded. It is already up on the Spitfire List website, just the audio track. I do not have the description ready. For those of you who are listening live, this program recorded that actually precedes this will air live on KFJC tomorrow evening between 6 and 7 p.m. There is so much going on, well, in the world as a whole and vis-a-vis the coronavirus, which I am convinced is a manifestation of hybrid warfare, a combination of a biowarfare weapon combined with weaponized media and social media. I believe they're the full court press strategy that I outlined in some of the series about the destabilization of China is underway. I think China will be not only brought, but certainly the attempt is being made to bring China to its knees. I think given what may very well result, I think that might turn out to be the case. It is likely to be disastrous for the human race as a whole. I've been talking about the economic effects of that. We'll do at least one more show next week about China and the coronavirus at all. There is an awful lot else going on, and as I indicated in the last show, Trump pulled U.S. forces out of Idlib province, basically stabbed the Kurds in the back and gave Turkey a free hand in Idlib province. Elements of Islamic State that had back in the day been aligned with Al-Qaeda may very well be realigning with Al-Qaeda. The Al-Qaeda in Syria, Al-Qaeda in Iraq in Syria was called the Nusra Front. They have another name, which I cannot recall offhand. But there may very well be a war between Russia and Syria on one side and Turkey on the other. I think that is part of the plan. And we will be talking about weaponized media and the New York Times in particular. The Uyghurs, who are an Islamic Turkophone people in resource and petroleum resource, mineral rich and petroleum rich Xinjiang province. That's Xinjiang. I'm probably mispronouncing that. They have been a focal point for a destabilization of China since the early 1950s. They are aligned with Turkey. They are also aligned with the Muslim Brotherhood, and at least there are those elements with their fingers in the Uyghur pie, to coin the term. And the Uyghur jihadis are fighting they fought with Al-Qaeda, actually engaged U.S. combat troops in combat in Afghanistan shortly after the invasion of that country following the 9/11 attacks of 2001. I suspect that part of the long-term goal is to break up both Russia and China and have the Turkic and Islamic peoples of the Caucasus, Russia's oil-producing area, in a neo-Ottoman empire. As wacky as this will sound, certainly a lot would have to happen. But I think the game plan may very well be to have a neo-Ottoman empire embracing the Caucasus and the Uyghurs in Xinjiang province after both Russia and China have been brought to their knees and broken up. Whether that results in a third world war remains to be seen. But I think the events going on in Syria and Turkey are part of the, what I have called in the past, the Earth Island boogie, or what we might think of as an Earth Island op. I believe, as I've indicated in the past, that the coronavirus outbreak is part of a hybrid warfare program against China. In our last show, we reviewed how anti-Chinese sentiment has captivated Washington, the Congress, of the national security establishment, and everybody else. At the epicenter of it is Steve Bannon. And I will also note, Steve Bannon tied to J. Kyle Bass and the investors positioned to profit from a downturn in the Chinese economy. Many, many elements of the global economy will be turning down because of this. I wonder how many insiders have been alerted to this. I also noted in our last show that Robert Mercer, the brilliant investor and head of Renaissance Technologies, who is Steve Bannon's financial angel, one wonders about what stocks he may have shorted or purchased. One of his largest holdings is in Gilead Pharmaceuticals, that may be positioned to make a lot of money off of the coronavirus epidemic or outbreak. As we know, remdesivir, an experimental antiviral made by Gilead, has apparently proved of some use in combating the coronavirus, and the Chinese have applied for a patent on that, but that is owned by Gilead, and in turn, Robert Mercer has a whole lot of money invested in that stock. And if the enormous Chinese market and around the world, the remdesivir drug does indeed become the go-to cure for coronavirus, that is going to be a huge windfall for remdesivir and for Robert Mercer, who is the financial angel of Steve Bannon, Cambridge Analytica et al., and Breitbart. I've been talking about, and we'll discuss some more about, weaponized media. I want to review something. Well, a few things should be discussed in this context for people that will think, oh my God, you know, there goes Dave Emery again. I knew he was nuts, but here he goes with a wacky conspiracy theorist. A virus of this kind, as we have demonstrated, was synthesized in 2008. And information about that is in the descriptions for the record, 1111 and 1112. Whether or not that has any connection with the virus that produces the current epidemic or whatever it is, the outbreak, because really so far there haven't been that many people infected, something like 50,000 infected, 1,300 to 1,400 deaths. That will escalate. Compare that with the flu outbreak in the U.S. in the winter of 2017 and 2018. 45 million Americans out of a population a fifth the size of China were demonstrating symptoms or were symptomatic. 80,000 of them died, according to the CDC. And yet we weren't hearing this chicken little, oh my God, the sky is falling. If in fact this is a biowarfare psyop, as I believe, that virus could be disseminated in China or around the world as people see fit, and perhaps weaponized as well. We'll see what happens. But to date, between 1,300 and 1,400 people have died in the country, five times the size of the U.S. In the winter of 2017-2018, in that flu season, 45 million Americans were symptomatic, 80,000 of them died. And yet, we didn't hear about this. Oh my God, you know, look out, you know, and, that is something of a cue to the weaponized nature of our media. Now, in the For the Record program 1111 and 1112, also in a sidebar food for thought article, a Dr. Joseph Mercola, last name, M-E-R-C-O-L-A, had a post on his website worthy of note for a number of things, including the fact that there was a moratorium on the testing of viruses of this kind that was lifted at the end of 2017. Now, in December of 2019, and bear in mind that a virus of this kind was synthesized in an American laboratory that was published in November of 2008, that it was a synthetic coronavirus believed to be a precursor of the SARS virus or coronavirus, and it was it could reproduce or replicate in human cell cultures and in mice. I have wondered about the worldwide freakout, and I think the banning on travel, which we discussed in our last program, and to an extent in, for the record, 11-12, is indicative. That has cut China off from not only its largest trading partner, the U.S., but from other countries as well. Some reflections on that from Dr. Merkel's website. He notes, and I'm reading again, equally curious is the fact that Johns Hopkins Center for Health Security, the World Economic Forum, and the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation sponsored a novel coronavirus pandemic preparedness exercise on October 18th, 2019 in New York called, quote, Event 201, unquote. The simulation predicted a global death toll of 65 million people within a span of 18 months. As reported by Forbes of December 12th of 2019, quote, the experts ran through a carefully designed, detailed simulation of a new fictional viral illness called CAPS, or Coronavirus Acute Pulmonary Syndrome. This was modeled after previous epidemics like SARS and MERS, that the latter comes out of the Middle East. Sounds exactly like NCIP, doesn't it? That is the coronavirus that has caused the Chinese outbreak. And then he goes on, yet the new coronavirus responsible for NCIP had not been identified at the time of the simulation, and the first case wasn't reported until 2 months later. Forbes also refers to the fictional pandemic as Disease X, unquote, the same designation used by the Telegraph in its January 24, 2020 video report, quote, could this coronavirus be Disease X, unquote, which suggests that media outlets were briefed and there was coordination ahead of time with regard to use of certain keywords and catchphrases in news reports and opinion articles. I wonder about that exercise. That is awfully, to my mind, suspicious. There is an old saying that in politics, nothing happens by accident. It has been attributed, I've heard incorrectly, to Franklin Delano Roosevelt. But note again that at the end of 2017, a moratorium on testing viruses of this kind was lifted. The U.S. had synthesized a virus like this in the middle of the previous decade. I also wonder about the severity of the winter 2017-2018 flu outbreak. Might that have had something to do with it? Could there have been a weaponized flu released to test things? I would note they've been, for the record, 55. We noted how Fort Detrick scientists identified, or from the Army's Institute of Infectious Diseases, which occupies part of the old Fort Detrick Biological Warfare Center, had obtained some of the genome for the 1918 flu pandemic that killed millions worldwide. Has there been a weaponized flu? Was that tested? Had there been a test of a coronavirus, which was then attributed perhaps accidentally, perhaps because of some tweaking and cover-up? Did that have anything to do with the severe flu outbreak, flu season of 2017-2018? I don't know, and past a point, it doesn't really matter. What is significant is that the absence of coverage. 45 million Americans symptomatic, 80,000 dead, this in a country a fifth the size of China. And yet, we are hearing this, you know, the sky is falling, China has been cut off, more about the Chinese reaction in a minute. I do not have it with me, but in the Rosie Spinks op-ed column in the New York Times that I read into the record in our last program, that from February 7th of this year, a week ago tomorrow, it was noted that the cutting off all travel is not the best way of handling something like this. In Indonesia, which obviously occupies the same general part of the world as China, Indonesia has not had a single case of the coronavirus to date. That has been attributed to the fact that at their airports, they have effective medical screening processes, some of the ones that Ms. Spinks recommended, and that is in place because of the MERS coronavirus that originated in the Middle East. It is present in Saudi Arabia, and because Indonesia is it is a Muslim country. It is the most populous Muslim country. And many Indonesians each year make the Hajj, the obligatory pilgrimage to Mecca in Saudi Arabia. They are being screened for possible MERS infection upon return to Indonesia. To date, and I will have this, it was in the New York Times in the last day or two, not a single case of coronavirus in Indonesia, a very large country. That medical screening procedure, which has become institutionalized in Indonesia, was recommended by Ms. Spinks. Instead, there has been this cutting off of all travel and trade, and the effect on the markets. Note again that J. Kyle Bass and perhaps Tommy Hicks as well, part of Team Trump and linked to Steve Bannon, are positioned to have an asymmetric investment fortune, two fortunes in China and Hong Kong. In other words, if they go down, Kyle Bass's fortunes go up. He made his fortune betting against the subprime mortgage phenomenon in the early part of the last decade. Basically, he got rich while everyone else ate, or an awful lot of us ate it raw, when the housing market and the financial sector collapsed in 2008. One of the things that has been most striking to me has been the weaponization of the media. And a coronavirus-related story that I touched on in both, for the record, 11-12 and 11-13, New York Times, Wednesday, January 29th of 2020. Now, this is about Hong Kong. Note the following. This is weaponized media. This is by Austin Ramsey, R-A-M-Z-Y, Dateline Hong Kong. Virus fears put a fractured Hong Kong on edge. Note the lead. This is really significant. The two Hong Kong protesters were dressed head to toe in black, their faces covered in masks. They smashed their Molotov cocktails into the lobby of a public housing estate, and flames and smoke began spewing out. This was no scene from the protest violence last year over Beijing's dominance of Hong Kong's affairs. This was on Sunday, and the firebombing was incited by anger over the coronavirus that originated in Wuhan, China, and plans by the Hong Kong government to use the unoccupied housing block as a quarantine area. If you were sitting in a coffee shop, say Starbucks or Pete's, or in a restaurant or in any building, and two people dressed head to foot in black wearing masks walk in and toss Molotov cocktails, setting the place alight, you wouldn't be saying, oh, we're a couple of protesters exercising their right to free speech. No, that is not protest. That is terrorism. And I've noted that in connection with the unrest in Hong Kong, which, as a matter of record, has links to U.S. intel cutout funding vis-a-vis the coronavirus outbreak. Had that occurred in a vacuum, I would say, well, maybe, maybe not. It did not, however. It not only occurred in the middle of an obvious destabilization effort against China involving the Uyghurs, involving NEB, a CIA cutout funding of all of the key individuals and organizations involved in the Hong Kong unrest, with Steve Bannon at the epicenter of the anti-China movement, and with apparently a coalescing of all of the key elements of the U.S. government and economy in the anti-China effort. This did not occur in a vacuum. Plus, the timing, the outbreak coincided with the Chinese Lunar New Year holiday, which is their biggest holiday, also a big travel day, and it has apparently caused a great deal of angst in China. Before I move on with some of the indications not only of weaponized media, the Chinese response is something I have more questions about than answers. Obviously, they have basically shut the country down to a large extent vis-a-vis travel. There have been allegations that the People's Liberation Army, among other elements, have charged that the coronavirus is U.S. biological warfare. I don't know if those allegations are true. There is so much fresh fertilizer, some of it involving, you know, fragments of truth, but embellished with all sorts of anti-vaxxer and all sorts fresh fertilizer, that, well, that there is not, I've never seen any definitive confirmation of that. I wonder if China is aware of the possibility, or maybe more than a possibility. Does that have something to do with the Chinese reaction to this outbreak? Again, in a country roughly five times the U.S., there have been to date, as I speak on the 13th of February, roughly a little under 50,000 confirmed cases and over 1,300 deaths. Compare that with the 2017-2018 flu epidemic in the U.S., a country a fifth the size, 45 million people symptomatic, 80,000 dead. And that is really nothing. And yet, there has been a huge draconian reaction in China. Is that reflexive overreaction, or do they know something that we don't? I would note that there have been pictures of Chinese personnel fumigating places like stations and other places. That would not appear to be of any value whatsoever to combat the coronavirus per se, but the virus that was developed in the U.S. laboratory can be communicated via mice. The prevailing theory is that this virus originated in bats and may have come from an open air livestock market, a type that exists in China. I don't know, but I wonder if the fumigation has the intent of preventing mice or other possible vectors from spreading. It would not surprise me one bit if the Chinese were aware of the aid that the U.S. developed a device, a virus like this in the laboratory, that there is an obvious destabilization effort against China, the Hong Kong situation, the Uyghurs, whom I spoke about in our series about the destabilization of China. It would not surprise me one bit. The weaponization of our media, though, as I noted in my last program, every day the New York Times has anywhere from two, I've seen as many as five pages on the inside dealing with the coronavirus. And they generally are of a type. There have been many articles about the effects of this on the global economy, because China is the second largest economy in the world, and many others are linked to that. The articles have generally been how bad China is, how bad the Chinese Communist Party is, how bad their health system is, and all sorts of really scary articles about this. And one of the things I find so significant about the coronavirus is the fascistic manifestation of this. Not only the anti-Chinese racism, frankly, but the panic effect of what I believe are weaponized media and online media as well. Part of the title of this show is The Chinese Winter. That is borrowed directly from the Arab Spring, which, as I noted in a series I did in For the Record program number 2010, by the way, actually it was 2011 when I talked about that. And came back to that in a series about the landmark text by Yasha Levine, Surveillance Finale. The Arab Spring was an op using social media. Fascism, although it is, you know, as Mussolini noted, il fascismo è il corporatismo. Fascism is corporatism. At a psychosocial level, it is bundlethink. The fascus is that symbol of the Roman Republic, a bundle of sticks bound with a leather thong and an axe head. At a psychosocial level, it is bundlethink. And the combination of anti-Chinese xenophobia and bundlethink is something that one of the really striking aspects of this bug. You see people in the U.S. with masks on and a shortage of surgical masks. Again, under 50,000 people in China have been affected, 1,300 to 1,400 deaths. Compare that with the flu epidemic in this country in 2017, 2018. You didn't hear about that, did you? People weren't freaking out about that. That would be a hell of a lot worse and much more immediate. The New York Times of Friday, January 31st of 2020, had an article by Motoko Rich, Virus Fuels Anti-Chinese Sentiment Overseas. In Japan, the hashtag Chinese Don't Come to Japan has been trending on Twitter. In Singapore, tens of thousands of residents have signed a petition calling for the government to ban Chinese citizens from entering the country. In Hong Kong, South Korea, and Vietnam, businesses have posted signs saying that mainland Chinese customers are not welcome. In France, a front-page headline in a regional newspaper warned of a, quote, yellow alert, unquote. And in the suburb of Toronto, parents demanded that a school district keep children of a family that had recently returned from China out of classes for 17 days. The rapid spread of the coronavirus that has sickened about 9,800 people, the overwhelming majority in China, this was as of January 31st, with all of the 213 deaths there, has unleashed a wave of panic and in some cases outright anti-Chinese sentiment across the globe. I would add, including and especially the U.S. While public health officials scrambled to contain the crisis, the World Health Organization declared a global health emergency on Thursday. Fears over the dangerous outbreak have fueled xenophobia. And the wave of spreading panic has at times far outstripped practical concerns. At the time when China's rise as a global economic and military power has unsettled its neighbors in Asia as well as its rivals in the West, the coronavirus is feeding into latent bigotry against the people of mainland China. Quote, Some of the xenophobia is likely undergirded by broader political and economic tensions and anxieties related to China, which are interacting with more recent fears of contagion, unquote, said Christy Kariasti-Govella, capital G-O-V-E-L-L-A, an assistant professor of Asian studies at the University of Hawaii, Manoa. And the article goes on in that vein, the same edition of the New York Times, talking about panic in China. After days on lockdown, anger boils over and doctors plead for aid, by Chris Buckley and Amy Kim. Note the following, and bear in mind that in the ProPublica article that I read into the record in 11-11 and 11-12, Commerce Secretary Wilbur Ross and the Department of Commerce have been heavily involved in the anti-China effort, specifically guarding against or attempting to neutralize China's bid for 5G and the Huawei electronics company.
You're listening to Dave Emery's For the Record. You can subscribe to the comments posted on the SpitfireList.com website, most of them by a brilliant contributing editor who uses the moniker Terra Fractal, specializing, but by no means exclusively, in economic and financial matters.
In this article, skipping up, the American Commerce Secretary Wilbur Ross said the United States could see a positive byproduct from China's woes because the outbreak could prompt employers to move jobs to its shores. Quote, I don't want to talk about a victory lap over a very unfortunate, very malignant disease, Mr. Ross said in an interview on Fox Business. Quote, I think it will help to accelerate the return of jobs to North America, some to the U.S., probably some to Mexico as well. Well, in all probability, if in fact this causes corporations to disengage from China, Chinese consumption is going to go down. It's going to hurt a lot of people, but they will go to other third world countries. I would note that some of the jobs that outsourcing that has already been relocated has gone to Vietnam. The fears about China is because of its Communist Party. Vietnam is also communist. Now note the following. In Paul Krugman's column, in that very same edition of the New York Times, Friday, January 31st of 2020, he talks about how uninformed Wilbur Ross is about the effects of the coronavirus on the U.S. economy. He said it's not going to help the U.S. It will result, if anything, in harm to the U.S. economy. But many investors, however, may be positioned to benefit from that, particularly if they had a tip that it was going to happen. But he talks about Wilbur Ross. This is Trump's Team Fails Microbe Economics by Paul Krugman, again, New York Times, Friday, January 31st of 2020, not quite 2 weeks ago. Skipping down. Sure enough, Wilbur Ross, the Commerce Secretary, appeared on Fox Business on Thursday morning to declare the quote, he didn't want to talk about a victory lap, unquote, but that the coronavirus will help to accelerate the return of jobs to North America. This may be a very good talking point for Trump in the campaign later this year. It also is almost certainly untrue. I found that interesting in light of Wilbur Ross and the Commerce Department's involvement in the anti-China effort, again, in that ProPublica article read into the record in For the Record 11-12 and For the Record 11-11. It goes into that. I would note the following, though. Paul Krugman does a great job with economics. I have not been impressed by some of his observations in other areas. He fell for the whole okey-doke on Russiagate, whole hog. Look the following. How frightened should you be about the coronavirus? I'm no epidemiologist, but what I've seen looks pretty scary. Actually, it doesn't look really scary, but the media have been making it out to be just an absolute trauma. Now, again, with biowarfare, you could have anywhere from Falun Gong people to Uyghurs to Spec Op troops to people from Hong Kong or Taiwan spreading this around in China or elsewhere. So it could be made to be as bad as anyone wants it to be. I do wonder if the Chinese are aware of this, and does that have anything to do with the nature of the Chinese reaction? Are they worried about vectors? Is that why they are spraying areas that wouldn't have anything, that wouldn't do anything to a virus? But are they worried about contagion from mice or something else? Are they worried about biological warfare? Is the travel lockdown perhaps intended to keep an eye out for people who are spreading this? I don't know. It is a question. But the weaponized nature of our media. Also, again, I termed this the Chinese winter. Social media in China, its social media component is much greater than it was in years past. Social media are perfect for stoking the psychological fires of fear about this or anything else. When a story achieves tremendous distribution online, it is spoken of as going viral, unquote. Well, if you want to really have things go viral, spread alarm via the internet and via social media. There was an article that began on the front page of the New York Times a few days ago about a three generations of a family in Wuhan that had caught the virus. And in the inside, said, what kind of a country is this? You know, from one of the people who's affected. You know, people are generally fairly frail, and in the absence of good information, they are very likely to freak out. I wonder, in China's case, where they have had a one-child policy, and this is pure rumination, and this, some people may find this offensive. It is not meant to denigrate single children or only child, or only children in the U.S. or anywhere else. But I wonder if perhaps China's one-child policy has made their citizenry more vulnerable to this kind of thing. But the use of online media, and we went into that in our series about the Arab Spring, in our series about Surveillance Valley, would be remarkable. I will also note in this context that in For the Record 1112 and 1113, I went into three articles in the same edition of the New York Times. That was last Friday, February 7th. There was an article in the front section about how vulnerable Africa would be to the virus. China has been making significant inroads in Africa. Then in the business section, talking about a Trump administration business or trade initiative to Kenya to counteract Chinese influence in Africa. There also was a statement by William Barr, the quote ex-unquote CIA officer, who was Attorney General under George H.W. Bush, for whom CIA headquarters is named, and who pardoned many of the key Iran-Contra players just before Bush left office in January of 1992, or at the end of his term. It might have been in December. William Barr warned about Huawei and its 5G capabilities, and again, Wilbur Ross, along with Tommy Hicks, investment partner probably, with Kyle Bass, betting against the Chinese economy, was involved with those negotiations and the discussions. Again, that ProPublica article that we accessed in For the Record 1111 and 1112. In the midst of all of this, New York Times, Tuesday, February 11th of 2020, front page by Katie Benner. Justice Department charges four Chinese in Equifax hack. Four members of Chinese military were charged on Monday with hacking into Equifax, one of the nation's largest credit reporting agencies, and stealing trade secrets and the personal data of 145 million Americans in 2017, after Trump got in. The charges underscored China's quest to obtain, anyway, it talks about that. The China's, the charges underscore China's quest to obtain Americans' data and its willingness to flout a 2015 agreement with the U.S. to refrain from hacking and cyber attacks, or in an effort to expand economic power and influence. Now, I am not in the position to, I'm not a cyber expert, and I can't say, obviously, if the Chinese were involved. If, in fact, they were, that would have been an incredibly stupid thing to do, and I haven't seen anything to indicate the Chinese are idiots any more than the BS, and that's what it is, about the Russian hacks, the high-profile hacks, which are, even to a layperson, which I am, are just ludicrous. The very first, quote, hack, unquote, of the DNC, supposedly by Russia, used an outdated software, an outdated PAS shell, with the hacker's IP address hard-coded into the malware. Hackers don't do that. That is a cyber false flag operation. And I think one has to ask the same question about the Equifax hack. Reviewing from the Heavy blog of April 3rd of 2017 by Stephanie Dube, D-U-B-E-D-Wilson, D-W-I-L-S-O-N. WikiLeaks Vault 7 Part 3 reveals CIA tool might mask hacks as Russian, Chinese, or Arabic. This morning, WikiLeaks released part 3 of its Vault 7 series called Marble. Marble reveals CIA source code files along with decoy languages that might disguise viruses, trojans, and hacking attacks. These tools could make it more difficult for antivirus companies and forensic investigators to attribute hacks to the CIA. Could this call the source of previous hacks into question? It appears that yes. This might be used to disguise the CIA's own hacks to appear as if they were Russian, Chinese, or from specific other countries. Was that, in fact, a Chinese hack, or was this the CIA masking that as Chinese as part of the anti-Chinese effort? I will also note in that context, if one reads in into the text of that article, further down into it, it speculates about the use of private information about American government employees, including national security people and military people, to look for vulnerabilities that they could use for blackmail. That would also be something of interest to the CIA. So again, with the history of utter BS about the Russian high-profile hacks, etc., etc., I think there is more than a little reason to question the Mr. Barr's observations about the Equifax hack. It's funny how our media operate. Generally, the liberal media, those that are considered liberal, view Barr with a jaundiced eye, as well they should, but they take what he says about this at face value. And that would be a big mistake. Now, about weaponized media, we may not have time for all of this. We're going to talk about the New York Times and the CIA and other institutions. There was an op-ed, a letter to the editor of the Times on October 25th of 2019, last year. The Times owes an apology, this a letter to the editor, and this was in response to an op-ed, but for emails talking about the Trump administration's continued obsession with Hillary Clinton's emails. And the writer, a Jeremy Fassler, F-A-S-S-L-E-R, from Brooklyn, writes, "I am disappointed that the Times did not use the opportunity to apologize for its obsessive coverage of this Hillary Clinton non-scandal in 2016. One more time. I am disappointed that the Times did not use the opportunity to apologize for its obsessive coverage of this Hillary Clinton non-scandal in 2016. According to an article in the Columbia Journalism Review, quote, in just 6 days, the New York Times ran as many cover stories about Hillary Clinton's emails as they did about all policy issues combined in the 69 days leading up to the election. Again, as many front page stories in 6 days during the campaign about Hillary Clinton's emails as there were front page stories about policy issues in 69 days. Then the writer goes on. Mrs. Clinton lost the election for myriad reasons, but it did not help that the Times' coverage of this issue reinforced many voters' suspicions that she was untrustworthy. Jeffrey Toobin, TWOBIN, chief legal analyst for CNN, apologized this week for hyping the email story during that crucial moment. If the Times wants to regain the trust of its readers heading into 2020, it should do the same. We're going to talk now about the relationship between the Times and the CIA. We're going to talk about Alan Dulles and his relationship with Arthur Hayes Sulzberger of the New York Times. However, I've spoken often about about Alan Dulles, his brother John Foster Dulles, in their decisive roles in helping to arm the Third Reich and taking in the cream of their national security establishment after the war. John Foster Dulles also deeply involved with the Golden Lily machinations. They were working for Sullivan and Cromwell, which is at the epicenter of American power structure, by way of underscoring how central the Dulleses and Sullivan Cromwell are to American power structure. From the book The Brothers, John Foster Dulles, Alan Dulles, and Their Secret World War by Stephen Kinzer, published in 2013 by St. Martin Griffin. Of Sullivan and Cromwell, to give you an idea of how important they are. In 1882, it created Edison General Electric. That became GE. 7 years later, with the financier J.P. Morgan as its client, it wove 21 steelmakers into the National Tube Company, and then in 1891, merged National Tube with 7 other companies to create U.S. Steel, capitalized at more than $1 billion, an astounding sum at that time. The railroad magnate E.H. Harriman, whom President Theodore Roosevelt had denounced as a, quote, malefactor of great wealth, unquote, and, quote, an enemy of the Republic, unquote, hired the firm to wage 2 of its legendary proxy wars, one to take over the Illinois Central Railroad, and another to fend off angry shareholders at Wells Fargo Bank. It won the first with tactics that a New York newspaper called, quote, one of those ruthless exercises of the power of sheer millions, unquote, and the second with complex maneuvers that, according to a book about the firm, amounted to, quote, deceit, bribery, and trickery that was all legal, unquote. Soon afterward, working on behalf of French investors who were facing ruin after their effort to build a canal across Panama collapsed, Sullivan and Cromwell achieved a unique triumph in global politics. Through a masterful lobbying campaign, its endlessly resourceful managing partner William Nelson Cromwell persuaded the United States Congress to reverse its decision to build a canal across Nicaragua and to pay his French clients $40 million for their land in Panama instead. Then he helped engineer a revolution that pulled the province of Panama away from Colombia and established it as an independent country led by a clique willing to show its gratitude by allowing construction of a canal on terms favorable to the U.S. One newspaper called him, quote, the man whose masterful mind whetted on the grindstone of corporate cunning, conceived and carried out the rape of the isthmus, meaning Panama. So that is the decisive position of Sullivan and Cromwell in American corporate and political power structure. Now, in the Rolling Stone magazine of October 20th of 1977, there was a now famous article by Carl Bernstein of Watergate fame, The CIA and the Media, of the relationship between New York Times and Arthur Hayes Sulzberger, its publisher, and Alan Dulles of Sullivan and Cromwell and CIA. We read, skipping down, The New York Times. The agency's relationship with the New York Times was by far its most valuable among newspapers, according to CIA officials. From 1950 to 1966, about 10 employees were provided Times cover under arrangements approved by the newspaper's late publisher Arthur Hayes Sulzberger. The cover arrangements were part of a general Times policy set by Sulzberger to provide assistance to the CIA whenever possible. Sulzberger was especially close to Alan Dulles. Quote, At that level of contact, it was the mighty talking to the mighty, unquote, said a high-level CIA official who was present at some of the discussions. Quote, There was an agreement in principle that, yes, indeed, we would help each other. The question of cover came up on several occasions. It was agreed that the actual arrangements would be handled by subordinates. The mighty didn't want to know the specifics. They wanted plausible deniability. Indeed, Alan Dulles, of course, arguably the most important member of the Warren Commission that covered up JFK's assassination. The Warren Report was published by the New York Times. To give you an idea we've covered this before, but to review and by way of giving an idea about Alan Dulles' political orientation, and both Dulles and his brother John Foster were inextricably linked with the cartel agreements that helped to arm Nazi Germany, and they were inextricably linked not only with the cover-up of SAME and the frustration of Operation Safe Haven, but Alan Dulles was deeply involved with the incorporation of the Galen Organization, first into the CIA and then as Charles Dewey's campaign manager. His official title was speechwriter, but he ran Dewey's campaign in 48. He helped to incorporate these same elements into the Republican Party. In his negotiations with Hans von Hohenlohe, was actually the member of the Habsburg family, a Habsburg in-law, who was conducting negotiations on behalf of Walter Schellenberg of the SS. We read the following. This in American Swastika by Charles Higham, soft cover, published by Doubleday, Incorporated in 1985. And Dulles talking to Max von Hohenlohe, who was, again, a Habsburg in-law and operating as a proxy for Walter Schellenberg, in charge of overseas intelligence for the SS. Dulles, quote, He said that it would be unbearable for any decent European to think that the Jews might return someday, and that there must be no toleration of a return to the Jewish power positions. He made the curious assertion that the Americans were only continuing the war to get rid of the Jews, and that there were people in America who were intending to send the Jews to Africa. Dulles reiterated his desire for a greater European political federation and foresaw the federal Germany that in fact took place. Germany would be set up as the dominating force in industry and agriculture in continental Europe, at the heart of a continental state run by Germany, the USA, and Great Britain as a focus of trade. That's basically the EU and the EMU. Dulles now proceeded to supply Hohenlohe with dollops of secret intelligence, announcing that the U.S. Army would not land in Spain, but after conquering Tunisia, would advance from Africa toward the Ploesti oil fields to cut off the German oil supplies. He said it was likely the Allies would land in Sicily to cut off Rommel and control Italy from there, and thus secure the advance in the Balkans. Having given virtually the entire battle plan for Europe top secret at the time to one of Germany's agents. Alan Dulles proceeded to the almost unnecessary reminder that he had very good relations with the Vatican. In other meetings, Dulles predicted that the next World War would be between the USA and the Soviet Union. This in the middle of World War II, 42, really late, I think early 43 was when this took place. He described a recent speech by Dr. Joseph Goebbels, propaganda minister of Germany, as, quote, a work of genius. I have rarely read such a speech. I have rarely read a speech with such rational pleasure. This indicating what fabric Dulles was composed of. Reviewing an element of how Dulles influenced the New York Times, and I don't think it requires much, to see Dulles' attitudes and influence here. From The Devil's Chessboard by David Talbot, that's a Devil's Chessboard. Alan Dulles, The CIA and the Rise of America's Secret Government by David Talbot. Hardcover by Harper. As the Congo crisis reached its climax, this is in 1960, a new correspondent for the New York Times showed up in Leopoldville with a distinctly anti-Lumumba bias. Paul Hoffmann was a diminutive, sophisticated Austrian with a colorful past. During the war, he served in Rome as a top aide to the notorious Nazi general Kurt Mauser, who was later convicted of the mass murder of Italian partisans. At some point, Hoffmann became an informer for the Allies, and after the war, he became closely associated with Jim Angleton. The Angleton family helped place Hoffmann in the Rome Bureau of the New York Times, where he continued to be of use to his friends in U.S. intelligence, translating reports from confidential sources inside the Vatican and passing them along to Angleton. Hoffmann became one of the Times' leading foreign correspondents, eventually taking over the newspaper's Rome Bureau and parachuting from time to time into international hotspots like the Congo. And wrapping up, in my long series of interviews with Jim Biagemio about his landmark book, Destiny Betrayed, softcover Sky Horse, we talked about Walter Sheridan, who had a special on NBC aired all over the U.S. It smeared Garrison and Sheridan, had links to every major intelligence service, the Office of Naval Intelligence, ONI, CIA, FBI, and NSA. And the centerpiece in his the coup de grace in his disinformation piece about Jim Garrison was the testimony of Fred Lemans, L-E-E-M-A-N-S. And he supposedly testified that Garrison bribed him to do this and that. Then in January of 1969, Lemans signed an affidavit in which he declared the following as the true chain of events. This, again, was the main element in that NBC, quote, documentary, unquote, organized by William Sheridan with more connections than a switchboard. I would like to state the reasons for which I appeared on the NBC show and lied about my contacts with the district attorney's office. First, I received numerous anonymous threatening phone calls relative to the information I had given to Mr. Garrison. The gist of these calls was to the effect that if I did not change my statement and state that I had been bribed by Jim Garrison's office, I and my family would be in physical danger. In addition to the anonymous phone calls, I was visited by a man who exhibited a badge and stated that he was a government agent. The man informed me that the government was presently checking the bar owners in New Orleans, Slidell area, for possible income tax violations. This man then inquired whether I was the Mr. Lemans involved in the Clay Shaw case. When I informed him that I was, he said that it was not smart to be involved because a lot of people that had been got hurt, and the people in powerful places would see to it that I was taken care of. One of the anonymous callers suggested that I change my statement and state that I had been bribed by Garrison's office to give him the information about Clay Shaw. He suggested that I contact Mr. Irvin Diamond, attorney for Clay L. Shaw, and tell him that I gave Mr. Garrison the statement about Shaw only after Mr. Lee, Garrison's assistant DA, offered me $2,500. And that is just part of what Fred Lehman's had to say. Again, we went into this at great length in my 25 one-hour interviews with the brilliant Jim DiGiamio, author of Destiny Betrayed, and this was just part of how the media behaved in the context, with regard to Jim Garrison's investigation. In those interviews, I stated many times that I thought the role of the media as active co-conspirators in the case and accessories after the fact was arguably the most important part of his book, meaning Destiny Betrayed, because we rely on the media for accurate information about world events. And I would counsel extrapolating to what we're hearing about the coronavirus as well. This concludes For the Record program number 1114, being recorded on February 13th of the year 2020. I'm Dave Emery. Have fun.